the end of Islam. By God's grace, we are living in momentous times, which I believe could be the beginning of the end of Islam. Now that might sound excessively optimistic, because it looks like Islam is advancing. In fact, Islam is advancing in Europe, and it is advancing in America. But Islam is losing ground in Africa. Significantly, they're losing ground in Africa. And many hundreds of thousands of Muslims are coming to Christ in Africa every year. Most Muslim states are the most severe persecutors of Christians. And radical Muslim extremists are the most vicious terrorists, hijackers, kidnappers, suicide bombers, and assassins in the world today. And yet, there are so many people who claim Islam is a peaceful and tolerant religion, a religion which respects women, a religion that is not violent. But look at what they put on their website. This is of a kid who was found stealing in the marketplace. And so, instead of cutting his hand off, they're going to crush his hand under a tire. Now, this is on a Muslim website. I mean, that is just bizarre. That is child abuse of a high order. Here you've got a crossroads. Notice a tenth crossroads with Muslims barring the traffic. Obviously, this is in America. It's in fact in New York. But when Muslims do this, they're blocking traffic. They're not just doing this because they want to pray. Because it's not really prayer. It's a political demonstration. And they're choosing a crossroads of a busy city. Why? To make a statement. To hold up traffic that can't be ignored. And this is not spiritual, because the Lord says when you pray, don't pray on the street corners. Pray quietly. And the Lord is not suggesting that we do things with a trumpet. But Islam is not like that. In the English-speaking world, any place where the British Empire was, the 11th of November is the holiest day of the year, in the sense of it is a day that we remember the hundreds of thousands of men who have died in combat in the wars, especially because the First World War ended on the 11th day of the 11th month. And the symbol of it is the poppy. Now, I've been to Flanders Fields, to the battlefields around Ypres, where the poppies grow. And there are 156 British and Commonwealth graveyards in the 10-kilometer radius around Ypres in Belgium. I counted 65 Hammonds, my family name, on the walls. Now, the ones on the walls are the ones they couldn't find the bodies of. And so they don't have a grave. So I didn't go around the graves, but just at, and I didn't go to all 156 cemeteries. I just went to a few. I saw 65 of my family name on the walls in Ypres. That's not the only battlefields. It was the bloodiest in the First World War. What are the... So the poppy is always symbolic on the 11th of November. People often wear the poppy to symbolize their remembrance of the soldiers who died. So what did Muslims in England do on the 11th of November? They marched against the British soldiers, demanding death penalty for those who oppose Islam, threatening a 9/11 for Europe, saying British soldiers burn in hell. Our dead on paradise, you're dead on hell. How's that for sensitive, gracious, good neighborliness? And they want Sharia for Britain. They also burned, I might add, poppies in public and rioted with the police in the end. This, at the end of the day, burning poppies, that's, by the way, the Hezbollah radical terrorist sign that they're using. And just look at the provocation. And now, you can see the police aren't trying to attack them. They're trying to attack the police. And yet you will have this. Democracy is the cause of oppression. Sharia is the solution. The world is divided into two camps, Islam and disbelief. Muslims will be victorious. There's Dar al-Harab, the house of war. There's Dar al-Islam, the house of peace. The only place of peace are the places under Sharia law. Can't you just feel the tolerance? And the peace. Europe is the cancer. Islam is the answer. Behit does in Sultan's law. Freedom go to hell. That is eloquent. Yet, the Muslims and the public relations agents and apologists claim that Islam is a great religion of learning and tolerance. I've heard Muslim imams of the Islamic Propagation Center International in the mosque in Durban say, we Muslims are more Jewish than the Jews. We're more Christian than the Christians. All over the world, repeatedly, Muslims claim Islam is superior to Christianity. You Christians are so divided. We Muslims are all united. You have so many denominations, but we Muslims are all one. In Islam, there is perfect unity. Christianity is a religion for the whites only. Islam is the black man's religion. There's no racism in Islam. We're all one in Islam. You Christians have so many Bibles. You keep changing the Bible. But we Muslims, we only have one Quran, and it's never been changed. Now, that's why I wrote the book Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, to expose these falsehoods and other myths prevalent about Islam. Because far from Islam being a great religion of learning and tolerance, well, it's the exact opposite. And that's why we need to set the record straight and give the facts. Muhammad declared that if other books confirmed what was in the Quran, they didn't need them. And if the books didn't confirm what was in the Quran, they didn't want them. His answer was burn them. The Muslims burned libraries all over North Africa and the Middle East, including the Library of Alexandria, with 6 million books and manuscripts. The greatest library in the world, Alexandria. Probably including original copies of the Bible and other priceless manuscripts.
And that was before the printing
press. Yeah, and that was, I mean, can you imagine the value? A book at that stage was worth probably a year's wages, average Bible-sized book. So, incredible destruction. Over 3,200 churches were destroyed or converted into mosques during the first century of the Islamic Jihad alone. And during the Muslim invasion of Syria, thousands of Christians massacred. Mesopotamia, Egypt, whole towns put to the sword. So where's this Muslim tolerance they keep talking about? In Cyprus, they looted and pillaged homes and churches, massacred much of the population. In North Africa, when they captured Tripoli, all the Jews and Christians were forced to hand their women and children over as slaves. When Carthage was captured, one of the greatest cities of the ancient world, it was burned to the ground, most of its inhabitants slaughtered. And yet Muslims will tell you with a straight face, Islam advanced peacefully, and Jihad is only defensive. But forget what they did in Christian North Africa and the Middle East. What they did in India was even worse. In 712, they began the invasion of India. They smashed and demolished Hindu temples, plundered palaces, slaughtered millions of Hindu men and enslaved the women and children. Huge amounts of cities destroyed and put to the sword, sacked, massacred. Not a temple was left standing anywhere the Muslims went. Will Durant, not a Christian, he's the author of The Story of Civilizations. He wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, for example. He describes the Muslim invasion of India as probably the bloodiest story in history. He claims, and there's quite a few other historians who agree, that more people died in the Muslim invasion of India in the 8th century than died in the entire First and Second World War combined on all sides. So it's the bloodiest story in history. The northwest region of India is still called the Hindu Kush, meaning the slaughter of the Hindu. As a reminder, the vast amounts of Hindu slaves who died while being marched across the Afghan mountains to the Muslim slave markets in Central Asia. By the way, this will help you make sense of why India and Pakistan are in a nuclear arms race and how they, why they're both threatening to annihilate one another nuclear. I would not be surprised if India and Pakistan exchange nuclear weapons sometime in our lifetime. Because they've been threatening to for a long time. And the hatred goes back so far. And the loathing between the Muslims despise the Hindus, and the Hindus fear and hate the Muslims. And the only thing that kept them together for years was the British Empire. And that's why at independence the British had to draw the map and let Pakistan go separate from India. But there's still 200 million Muslims in India. So it's not just the Muslims across the border, they're in India too. The Buddhists were also targeted for destruction, not just the Hindus. For example, in 1193, Muhammad Khilji burned to the ground the famous Buddhist library and stronghold of Bihar. Now, Shah Jahan might be one of the most famous of the Islamic leaders in India because he built the Taj Mahal. Now, you've probably seen a picture of Princess Diana sitting in front of the Taj Mahal, and it said the Princess of Hearts in front of the greatest monument of true devoted love in the world. Because this, believe it or not, is just a tomb. The Taj Mahal was built for the wife, they tell you the wife, but actually it's the favorite wife, of Shah Jahan. And this was built to the most skilled workmen from all over, tens of thousands of carpenters and stonemasons. And at the end of it, their right hand of everyone was cut off. So that they could never make anything as good again in their life. That's Shah Jahan's payment and appreciation for their work. But what few people know, this is not a monument to pure undevoted love. It's a monument to a bloodthirsty, mass-murdering lunatic. He launched 48 military campaigns in just 30 years. In 1628, he killed all his male relatives. He had 5,000 concubines in his harem. But he also indulged in incestuous sex with his own daughters. So, no, Shah Jahan is not an example of true devoted love. And I would think somebody should have better taught Princess Diana not to be associated with anything so lecherous and reprehensible. But in just one town, Banains, Shah Jahan destroyed 76 Hindu temples. He demolished Christian churches in Agra and Lahore. When he captured Hue, a Portuguese enclave near Calcutta, he had the 10,000 inhabitants blown up with gunpowder, drowned in water, or burned with fire. Another 4,000 were enslaved and offered Islam or death. Those who refused to convert were killed. So Shah Jahan is not exactly a good example. Neither was Spain under the Muslim Moors the jewel of Islamic tolerance that they love it to be. They often say, oh, look at Spain, for 800 years Muslims and Christians lived in harmony together. Rubbish. They put all inhabitants of Muez to the sword. Cordova, Zaragoza, Medina, burned to the ground. All adult males executed, all women and children enslaved. In 1066, all the Jews of Granada were slaughtered. 1126, all the Christians of Granada were deported to Morocco and made slaves there. So, those are just a few high points. In 1009, the Caliph Hakam of Egypt ordered the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre and all Christian places of worship in Jerusalem. Christians were severely persecuted, cruelly persecuted, and the pilgrims visiting the Holy Land were attacked. He destroyed over 30,000 churches, and all this before the Crusades began. Under Mehmed II, the Turks conquered the great Byzantine capital, Constantinople, the greatest city in the world at that time. 29th of May, 1453, waves of Turkish soldiers swept into Constantinople, the greatest city in the world at that time, and put it to the sword. Priceless libraries, irreplaceable works of art destroyed. The population slaughtered. Even in the Hagia Sophia, the greatest church in the world at that time, 12,000 people put to the sword. For centuries, the Turks demanded an annual blood levy of Christian boys. Parents are forced to hand over one out of every five Christian boys in service for the Sultan's army's janissaries, and they would choose. You'd line up all the Christian young men, and they would pick at least one fifth, but they'd always be the biggest, strongest, that sort of thing. And they became the shock troops, the expendables. Slavery, terrorism, Islam documents hundreds of massacres of Christian populations by Muslim rulers. Now, we could be here all week if we just listed it, but just a few examples. 1860, 12,000 Christians slaughtered in Lebanon. 1876, 14,700 Bulgarians murdered by the Turks. 200,000 Armenian Christians slaughtered by the Turks in Bayezid in 1877. 1915, the Turks massacred all 1.5 million Armenian Christians. Absolutely horrific, well documented, and to this day the Turkish history books don't even refer to it, they don't want to admit it, and it's one of the stumbling blocks to Turkey joining the European Union, because many people in Europe are saying, if you can't even acknowledge the Armenian genocide, then how can we allow you entrance into the European Union? Well, it's more serious than that. They've got 50 million Muslims who would then have free access to everywhere in Europe if they became a member of the European Union. 1922, the last Christian city in Asia, Smyrna, a biblical city, city where John was the apostle, put to the sword, its 300,000 Christian population wiped out. So despite Islam proclaiming itself as a religion of tolerance, no Muslim countries allow freedom of religion. Despite the Saudi Arabian government funding the building of thousands of mosques in Christian lands, there's not one church or synagogue tolerated in all of Saudi Arabia. Nor can any Saudi Arabian citizen be a Christian. Despite Muhammad being called a prophet of peace, he engaged in 47 battles and raids on caravans in his lifetime. It's inconsistent for Islam to insist on a cutting off of the hand of a thief when Muhammad and his successors engaged in wholesale theft, raiding caravans, kidnapping hostages for ransom, and looting homes. But the persecution of Christians by Muslims has become a taboo subject in most Western circles. Over 14 centuries of religious discrimination, persecution, causing suffering, oppression, murder, and enslavement of countless millions has been buried under the thick whitewash of myths of Islamic tolerance. I've learned from many people how their children have got to study magnificent Islamic architecture and great this, that, and the other. I mean, one of them was how one of the greatest architectures in the world is the mosque in Timbuktu. It's a mosque built of mud. Have you seen it? It's a mud mosque. It's quite well done because there's wood holding the mud together, but you can't compare that with the cathedrals of Europe and the stained glass windows. Are they crazy? But they're falling over themselves to find something to praise the Muslims about. The deceit and cowardice and silence of all too many Western journalists and academics continues to facilitate the religious discrimination and the persecutions of radical Muslims to this day. I took these three pictures. Evangelists whose feet have been axed off at the ankles in the new blindfolds. Pastor Vasco by the west wall of Fraser Cathedral in Lurie, the church that's been bombed 10 times, destroyed 3 times and keeps being rebuilt. And James Cromer, 52-year-old Anglican, had his arm cut off by the Arabs in the Nuba Mountains. Those are just some examples. But the intellectual dishonesty of those Westerners who engage in academic gymnastics to justify the invasion of other people's lands, the looting, pillaging, raping, murdering, enslaving of whole peoples, it needs to be exposed. Now, what's the prize-winning sandcastle competition here in Pakistan? A plane flying into a building. Isn't that really funny and nice? And isn't it good that they're peaceful and tolerant? And they'll pose with skulls of Christians, Turkish army. The hypocrisy of those who justify the military aggression of the Muslims, but condemn those who inflicted defeats upon the Muslim invaders, needs to be challenged. It's hypocrisy. If you want to condemn the Crusaders, then condemn the jihadists. But no, they want to condemn the Crusaders who were reacting, but not the jihadists who preceded and continued afterwards with the jihad. The fiction that jihad has never been an aggressive but only a defensive concept should be dismissed with the contempt that such deception deserves. What were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain? I was in a debate with a Muslim once, and I asked this very question. And he said, jihad is only for defensive purposes. So I said, what were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain? He stopped, he said, I like your style. But he never answered the question. He just ignored it. When Islam defines, now this is their double talk, when they define a refusal to submit to Sharia law under Islam as aggression, that is their understanding. So they say, Islam only fights a defense war against aggression. But if you refuse to live under Sharia law, you're guilty of aggression, according to Muslims. So when they define peace as submission to Islam, then we know we're not talking the same language. Let me give you an example of how this works. 7/7 bombings. You know that the TV in America and Britain is very, very, very liberal. So BBC goes along to the Regent's Park Mosque Imam. What's your comments about the terrorist bombings? Islam condemns all terrorism. And suicides are un-Islamic. Great. BBC broadcast this because those sound bites are just what they wanted. However, in Britain, the news media, the print media, is far more conservative. Well, by comparison to BBC, everything is conservative. So they're not happy with just a soundbite. They want depth. So they go further. So are you condemning the terrorism of these Muslim jihadists who blew up these commuters in the underground and in the double-decker bus? No, of course not. Well, what terrorism are you condemning? Well, we're condemning the terrorism of the Israeli Defense Force in Gaza and the British Army in Basra and the Americans in Afghanistan, Iraq. Oh, but I thought you said that all suicides are un-Islamic. They are. So you do condemn them for being suicides? No, we don't. Why not? Well, a suicide, the Imam said, is an act of desperation of someone who sees no reason to live. That is a sin in Islam. But these are not suicides. These are mujahideen, the holy warriors. They have sacrificed their life for a greater cause. And so they are not suicides, they are martyrs. So what actually were you condemning when you said you condemned all terrorism and suicides? No, we're condemning what the British and Israelis and Americans are doing. So the first soundbite sounded like they were condemning the terrorism of the 7/7 bombers, but actually he's doing nothing of the sort. And it just took a bit more probing to find out that they meant exactly the opposite of what you thought they meant with their first words. We're not talking the same language. Now in America and in Europe, at various airport chapels, I've noticed the increasing practice of providing prayer mats and qiblas to indicate the direction that Muslims must pray to face towards Mecca. And there's Qurans and there's glossy publications printed by the Embassy of Saudi Arabia promoting Islam, and overflows the chapel tables. Now these chapels were doubtless built by Christians for the purposes of Christians praying, and I've noticed over the years the chapels, the crosses come down, and often the Bibles are missing, or the Bibles are placed under a lot of Qurans, and regularly go there and sort of rearrange and put the Bibles more prominent. But you can't have a mosque and a chapel coexisting. They need to have two separate places. Even at Epcot Center in Disney World, this is the centerpiece of Epcot Center, and there's a Progress Through the Ages sort of train that goes all the way through here, and it's called A Progress Through the Ages, and it starts off praising the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Persians, and you go to all these great civilizations, the Romans of course, but then the barbarians come and Roman Empire falls, and so you see the few pillars lying on its side and some fires. Then as you go into darkness, a voice comes in the darkness saying, but all was not lost. Islam kept religion and learning alive in the dark ages. Now perhaps burning libraries provided some light, but the destruction of millions of books is hardly the way to keep learning alive. There is nothing in Epcot Center praising Christianity inventing hospitals, schools, universities, the nursing profession, scientific revolution, the printing press, nothing about Johannes Gutenberg and the print, nothing. I mean, that's not as important as praising Islam. They don't give one word of acknowledgement to Christianity, but the only religion given praise at Epcot Center is Islam. Spineless, lying, cowards. And then there's numerous films from Hollywood which have portrayed Christians as benighted, closed-minded bigots, and Muslim characters compassionate, intelligent, and enlightened. I gave a lot of attention to this obnoxious Kingdom of Heaven the other day. But let me say something about, some of you might have seen Kevin Costner's Robin Hood. none of the Christians, not even the monks, got any Christian faith. There's no religious sentiment or Christian faith amongst any English person, even the Crusaders, in Robin Hood of Kevin Costner. The only person with religious sentiment is this black Muslim who comes to England in the 12th century. Exactly. And he is an honorable, intelligent, and he brings gunpowder, by the way, in the 12th century to England. So he can have big explosions, enough to half-blood castle, it seems. How he kept it on while I was swimming and all that beats me, but anyway. And where they got gunpowder from centuries before it was invented, but don't worry about that, this is a Hollywood movie. But they've got a Muslim in a Robin Hood story who's got more faith than Friar Tuck. It's bizarre. The 13th warrior is even more pathetic. In the 13th warrior, it's about the Vikings. And the 13th warrior is this clean-shaven Muslim. You get a clean-shaven Muslim. And, okay. Who teaches the Vikings how to fight. Now, the Vikings were only the greatest soldiers the world's ever seen. Nobody ever beat the Vikings. And the Vikings were the ones hired by the Italians to clear the Muslims out of Italy and Sicily, and they did a thoroughly good job, but the Muslims could never stand against the Vikings. The Vikings beat the Muslims every day, all day, no exceptions. But in the 13th warrior, you've got a Muslim teaching Vikings how to fight. You have got to be kidding.
That's what the Vikings could fight so
hard.
They knew the Muslims' tactics.
Unbelievable strike. But this is the kind of nonsense that you get. All Christians are benighted, closed-minded bigots, and all Muslims are compassionate, intelligent, and enlightened. There's been a relentless barrage of anti-Christian bias and pro-Islamic propaganda generated by Hollywood filmmakers, liberal journalists, and college professors, all doing what Karl Marx said, the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. And that's why most people today don't read history books, but they see films that say, based on a true story, or inspired by true events. All names are true, just the facts that have been changed. Protect the guilty. Now, despite Muslims' claims to the contrary, the unity of Muslims is more like a thin veneer than a reality. Muslims are divided into three mega blocks. Now the Sunni, one of the part, the Sunni are something like our Protestants. It's the book that's most important. Then there are the Shiites, who are something akin to the Catholics, and they're more hierarchical. It's what the Ayatollah says. Who cares about the book? And so the Shiites are the ones who believe that Muhammad's son-in-law Ali is the true successor of Muhammad. They're the minority. But that's, for example, the religion of Iran. Think of the Sufis. They're the mystical, sort of charismatic sect of Islam. They're the sword-swallowing, fire-breathing, miracle-a-day crowd who have all kinds of limitations and strange things like that. But don't think they're all nice people, because the Sufis can be very violent. The Mahdi of Sudan, who killed everybody in the whole of Khartoum, including General Gordon, they were Sufis, for example. So don't think that any of these three blocks are pacifist. Now, these three mega blocks can be broken down to literally thousands of identifiable groupings. You could call them denominations if you wanted to. Major variations and distinctives. So something that's true for Muslim in Indonesia is not necessarily true for Muslim in Pakistan or India. There really are significant differences. And even within, there's breakdowns. You can go to Cape Town, and the Sufi and the Shiite and the Sunni are all there. And each mosque will have that. So for them to pretend that, oh, there's such unity. Well, their unity is not even as good as the Christian unity. Because we don't have civil wars against different denominations. They do. We haven't had a civil war between Christians in centuries. But unless you want to consider Northern Ireland an exception. But the Catholics and the Protestants are a very sharp difference. But Islam was arming, through Gaddafi, a lot of the IRA terrorists and training them. And the communists were doing a lot of the arming and training as well. There was a lot of Marxism on the IRA side too. So that wasn't a clear Catholic-Protestant battle only. There was a lot more involved in it. But still, excepting Northern Ireland, you can't point out in the last three centuries Christian civil wars. But Muslims, they have civil wars all the time. And massive amount of assassinations. One of the most obvious evidence of the divisions between Islam are the many wars between Muslims. Immediately after the death of Muhammad, there were the wars of apostasy. Caliph Abu Bakr was the first caliph or apostle who followed Muhammad, and there were the wars of apostasy, massive amount of killing. And the Muslim world has been torn from revolutions and assassinations. Every one of the first four caliphs, the apostles who followed Muhammad, were assassinated by other Muslims. So, I mean, just an example. We can't think of one of the apostles who was killed by another apostle, for example. Just since 1948, I've probably missed a few, but of the 21 Arab countries, there's been at least 40 wars. In fact, I'm not counting the Syrian war right now, or the Libyan one, so at least 42. At least 72, by now it's got to be 74 successful revolutions. I've got to count in Egypt times two, and Tunisia and Libya. At least 80 unsuccessful revolutions, and the murder of at least 40 heads of state. But I've probably missed a few. I'm just talking about the 21 Arab countries since the Second World War. Anyone recognize this event? 1981. The assassination of President Anwar Sadat by the Muslim Brotherhood. He is sitting at a state event in a presidential box. His army's marching past, and the Muslim Brotherhood group in the army suddenly turned and opened fire, killing everyone they could in the presidential box, including Anwar Sadat. Just to explain why President Sadat's vice president, Hosni Mubarak, banned the Muslim Brotherhood, and why he tried to suppress them for those 29 years. In the Arab world, revolutions and assassinations have been the most prevalent means of political expression and of attaining power. The only Arab country that was ever a democracy was Lebanon, and that was when Christians were the majority there. Lebanon was a crusader state. Lebanon had the descent of many crusaders and ancient Christians who lived there, and so Lebanon, when Christians were 65% of the population, was the only democracy in the Middle East. However, after the Syrian invasion and intensified persecution of Christians, many of the Christians fled, and the Muslims gained the majority, and then democracy in Lebanon was extinguished. So there's been no successful example of a Muslim democracy in the Middle East, except the one Arab country that had a Christian majority. As for the myth that there's only one Quran and it's never been changed, well, that's another falsehood. Both the times of prayer and the direction of prayer have been changed from the original Quran. Originally, Muhammad declared it was Allah's will that all Muslims pray towards Jerusalem. But after the Jews refused to accept his prophethood, Muhammad changed the direction of prayer from Jerusalem to Mecca. There's an obvious change. The third caliph, Caliph Uthman, forcibly standardized the many variations of the Quran. Even Muhammad in his lifetime said there are 8 different variations of the Quran in his lifetime. That's in Muhammad's lifetime. But now the Caliph Uthman, under pain of death, ordered every copy of the Quran to be surrendered, to be destroyed. At the end, he issued a new revised, standardized version of the Quran, which endures to this day. Now, not even the Roman Catholics have done that. As to there being only one version of the Quran, I've got on my shelf a number of Qurans, several of which I obtained from the Islamic Propagation Center International, including the translation commentary by Yusuf Ali and the translation by Muhammad Pickthall. There's also translations by Maulana Muhammad Ali, Ahmad Ali, J.M. Rodwell, A.J. Aubrey, M.H. Shakir, N.J. Dawood, and Muhammad Zafullah Khan. These are just the translations into English. We're not talking about the other languages. So I'm going to say there's only one Quran. And the differences between these various translations of the Quran can be very interesting. For example, the permitting of plunder in Surah 24:29. Rodwell translates it as, "There shall be no harm in your entering unoccupied houses for the supply of your needs." And MZ Khan adds, "Wherein are your goods?" So housebreaking is acceptable if the people aren't at home. Dawood inserts to seek shelter. Shakir and Ali insert an ambiguous where in you have your necessities. Hamad Ali writes, when there's some convenience for you, whereas Aubrey has a vague, when enjoyment is for you. What does that mean? Surah 434 or verse 38, you've always got to look a few before and after because they're not very consistent with their numbering. Sometimes you can find whole chapters and quite a few verses out. Dawood, Aubrey and Rodwell translate, as for disobedient wives, beat them. Whereas Ali and Khan prefer the more obscure translation, chastise them. Some Muslim translators like Ali have tried to soften Muhammad's savagery by retranslating verses like Surah 8:12, strike off their heads, strike off their fingertips with smite their necks and every fingertip. A little bit more vague, but you still get the general impression. Dawood translates Surah 8:68, a prophet may not take captives until he has fought and triumphed in the land. However, Rodwell uses these words in his translation, until he has made a slaughter in the earth. So plainly, the assertion there's only one Quran, and the Quran's never been changed, is false. Besides which, we never had to collect all the Bibles and burn them, so that you could come up with an authorized version. Similarly, the claim that there's no racism in Islam, we're all one, is a blatant lie. From the very inception of Islam, for its entire history, Muslims have made up the largest numbers of slave traders and engaged in the greatest slave trading campaigns in history. Even today, slavery continues in many parts of the Muslim world. Just about the only place in the world today where you will still find slavery is in the Muslim world. Muhammad was a slave owner. He traded in slaves. Throughout the Hadith, black people refer to slaves. In fact, in the Arabic language, it is impossible to distinguish between a black person and a slave. I've heard Muslim Christians say, if I'm speaking Arabic, I can't distinguish between a black brother and a slave. It's the same word in Arabic.
Sure.
The same word is used for slave and a black man. In the Hadith, Muhammad is quoted as referring to black people as raisin heads. That's just one of his derogatory terms he used. Several years ago, I was having a debate with Ahmadinejad, the founder of the Islamic Propagation Center International in Durban at the largest mosque in the Southern Hemisphere. Well, Dinejad tried to change the subject because he painted himself into a sticky corner by some theological gymnastics he was trying to get out of it. So he suddenly started chanting, "Kafirs! That's what the white people called the black people when it came to South Africa. Kafirs! That's what the whites call the black people. Kafirs!" And he carried on shouting repeatedly this refrain. He's trying to inject some racial animosity into our mixed group, of course. And he's trying to change the debate. So I asked him a question. But isn't kafir an Arabic word from the Quran? Isn't kafir the Arabic word for infidel? Wasn't it Muslim slave traders who gave the people of Africa the term kafirs? Ahmadinejad instantly changed the subject, never answered the question, never revisited the issue. I mean, that's the arrogance of these people. They know how to attack, but they are surprised when you counterattack. As for the Muslim claim that Christianity is a religion for the whites only, Islam is a black man's religion, well, that's a myth. Christianity long predates Islam in Africa for six centuries. Saint Mark, the author of Mark's Gospel, John Mark, of the book of Acts, he planted the church in Egypt in AD 62 and died for Christ in Alexandria. The Apostle Matthew, the author of Matthew's Gospel, planted the church in Abyssinia, what is today Ethiopia. Acts chapter 8 records the baptism of the treasurer of Queen Candace of Sudan by the deacon Philip. And from the first century, the church was firmly established in Egypt, Sudan, and Abyssinia. And it continues to be to this day. Christianity came to Africa before it even went to Europe. It was an African, Simon of Cyrene, who comes from what today is called Libya, who helped carry the cross of Christ. Notice the travels of the apostles. Matthew and Matthias ended up in Ethiopia. Thomas, India. Mark, to North Africa, to Egypt in particular. So, Christianity firmly established in Africa by apostles in the first century. Some of the greatest names in early church history were Africans, including St. Augustine of Hippo, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Origen, Athanasius, Cyprian, many great names. So the early church was very strong in North Africa. However, the Muslim armies wiped out the indigenous African church that had flourished in these countries, which then became Libya and Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco. Through the centuries, though, the Christians in Egypt, Sudan and Abyssinia have steadfastly resisted centuries of Islamic jihad and persecution. Many hundreds of Christians have been wounded or killed in violent attacks on Christian churches and neighborhoods, especially in Iraq and in Egypt. And right up to this last month, bombing, burning of churches in Egypt. But the Christians in Egypt sent me this message. They may destroy our churches, but they cannot destroy our faith. And so there's testimonies throughout Africa of Christians who have survived and thrived in spite of Islamic persecution for 14 centuries. Northern Nigeria as well. So for Islam to claim that it is the black man's religion is just not true. Throughout the centuries, the Christians in Egypt, Abyssinia, and Sudan have steadfastly resisted Islamic jihad and persecution. Far from Islam being the black man's religion, it's been the greatest affliction the black people have ever endured through 14 centuries of Islamic slave trade and oppression of Sharia law. By the way, this horrible picture depicts the implementation of Sharia law in Khartoum in 1885. As the Muslims conquered Khartoum, remember General Charles Gordon died defending Khartoum, great evangelical Christian who had set all the slaves free in Sudan. 7 out of 8 people in Sudan were slaves when General Gordon got there. He freed the slaves, and the Mahdi, the Sufi Muslim Messiah, rose up and they destroyed everybody. They killed every person, man, woman and child, Muslim, Christian, everyone, in the capital city of Khartoum, 1885. Today, despite Muslims being only 1/5 of the world's population, Muslim armies and terrorist groups are involved in 95% of the world's conflicts. It's no wonder that William Muir, one of the greatest Orientalists of all time, concluded at the end of his long and distinguished career, "The sword of Muhammad and the Quran are the most fatal enemies of civilization, liberty and truth which the world has ever known. Islam is an unmitigated cultural disaster parading as God's will." Now to this, many journalists and professors will claim that Islam was tremendously advanced scientifically and medically while Europe languished in the Dark Ages. However, as historian Ernest Renan observed, science and philosophy flourished during the first half of the Middle Ages, but it wasn't by reason of Islam. It was in spite of Islam. Not a philosopher or scholar escaped persecution. To give Islam the credit for so many illustrious thinkers who passed half their life in prison, in forced hiding, in disgrace, whose books were burned, whose writings were suppressed by their theological authority, is as if one were to ascribe to the Inquisition a whole scientific development which it had tried to prevent. I had one of these students at Michigan University say to me, "We Muslims had street lighting and flush toilets in North Africa in the 7th century. I said, "That's true, but you didn't in the 8th century, did you?" And he stumbled and he said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Because you conquered advanced Christian civilizations that had street lighting and flush toilets in North Africa. But after Islam had become the majority, all of these systems broke down." So it's not that Islam introduced those high standards, it's just that you hijacked them for a while. What most of these propagandists for Islam choose to forget is that the Arab armies conquered the advanced Christian civilizations in North Africa and the Middle East. So, yes, by reason of plunder and occupation, the Islamic empire was enriched and benefited immeasurably by loot. Sure. In fact, today you'll have Muslims claiming, we Muslims built the pyramids. Rubbish. Pyramids were built thousands of years before the Arabians invaded Egypt. The Copts built the pyramids. They will say, we invented algebra. Nonsense. The Syrian Christians invented algebra. The fact that the Muslims conquered the Syrian Christians area, they claimed credibility for it. But when people speak about this Arabic algebra, so not so. It's a Syrian Christian. Almost all the scientific and technological advancements in the Muslim world and all the hard work were the work of Christian slaves and dhimmis. Even the people who were writing out the Qurans and doing the transcribing were Christians, slaves normally, working for the Muslims. The engineers, the designers, the construction people, that everyone from the captains of their naval ships through to the architects were Christian dhimmis that they either were paying well or had forced into slavery. And that is why you get this quote from Sir Winston Churchill on the paralyzing effects of Islam and how wherever the followers of the Prophet rule or live, there is sluggish methods of commerce and of agriculture, and a degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement and the next of its dignity and sanctity. It's absolutely true that Islam and slavery have been linked, and until Islam is extinct, slavery will not be extinct. That was the conviction of Sir Winston Churchill. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. And that he wrote in the River War, which was after his battles in Sudan, Battle of Omdurman, in 1898. Now here you see mosques in London, Paris, Berlin, and Rome. Now faced as we are by the massive block of Islamic nations and the vast petrodollar funding of Islamic propagation centers and the building of thousands of mosques and madrasas throughout Europe, Africa, and Americas, what hope is there for the future? 9-11. Psalm 72 verse 9-11. The desert tribes will bow before Christ, and his enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him. That's the 9-11 of scriptures. Probably the most foolish thing Muslim radicals have ever done was hitting at the financial heart of America with their terror attacks on the New York World Trade Center and Washington with these hijacked aircraft. Since September the 11th, 2001, more critical books on Islam have been written than all the previous centuries combined. And we've begun to see the first cracks in the monolithic empire of Islam. The Taliban, probably the most radical Islamic regime in the world, in Afghanistan, toppled by American forces in a matter of months. For the first time, three elections were held in Afghanistan. Not that I think it's going to last, but it's something. Then Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, the military superpower in the Muslim Middle East, defeated by allied forces in a matter of weeks. And many people said that wasn't possible. Iraq was the Muslim superpower. They had the fourth largest army in the world, meant to be really good, well trained. But then the Americans organized the first free elections in Iraq's history. Then over the first free elections in Nigerian history, a Christian president came to power, Obasanjo. This after 38 years of Islamic dictatorship ruling Nigeria. Nigeria hosted the Islam in Africa conference and was officially recognized as a member of the World Islamic Organization. Abuja, their capital and center, has got this $150 million mosque with gold-plated roof. Gold-plated, not painted. Although Sharia law continues to be enforced in 12 northern provinces of Nigeria, with hundreds of churches having been burned and bombed, thousands of Christians massacred, the population of Nigeria has plainly rejected Islamic rule, Christian presence in power, and in fact, what they're doing with Boko Haram's attacks on churches is an act of frustration because they've lost so much ground. So many hundreds of thousands of Hausa Muslims in the north have been converted. Many of the churches being bombed are churches of ex-Muslims. Then in 2005, the National Islamic Front government of Sudan, which had waged jihad against Christian Black South for 50 years, seeking to impose its Islamization, Arabization policies, was forced to agree to a ceasefire and signed a comprehensive peace plan. And this peace treaty guaranteed autonomy to the South, led to a referendum where the South chose independence. Then Malawi, which had been ruled for 10 years by a Muslim president, elected a Christian president, President Binga wa Mutharika. You'll notice on the back of the Biblical Principles for Africa book, endorsed that book and ordered 100 copies for the members of his parliament. South Sudan's referendum in 2011 is epic, because here you have a country that had been part of the largest country in Africa breaking free. The first time they were able to redraw the map in Africa, really effectively, since the Berlin Conference of 1885. Now, some people say Eritrea, but of course Eritrea had been always independent, separate from Abyssinia. After the Second World War, they tried to force it into one. The Civil War just reverted back to the 1884 boundaries. So, but Sudan, after 5 decades of trying to subjugate the South, has given up. Governor of Sudan has had to cut the South free. Now, there still is fighting over Abyei and the oil fields, the disputed territories. But aside from that, South Sudan is the youngest country in the world, newest member of the United Nations, 197th member, and it's a free, independent country recognized by the world, something which people would have said was impossible when we began. I don't think General Omar al-Bashir of Sudan is very happy about it, but he can't do anything about it. His soldiers lost. And the sheikhs of northern Sudan are trying to impose more strict Sharia law north, but our friend Salva Kiir, the president of southern Sudan, is at the moment able to run a free, independent country. This is some of what the people said at the time. Unity by force is slavery. We need independence, peace and prosperity. And so they demanded a referendum. They got the referendum. They voted for separation. Over 98% voted for separation. Because, as I said, good fences make good neighbors. And they had enough of Arab colonialism. The Arabs had been inflicting their force on the south. You know, when the British left in 1955, the Arabs put 800 leaders in the south, of which only 2 were southerners, the rest were Arabs. So 798 of the 800 top leaders in the south were all Arabs. Just colonialism. And so the independence of South Sudan, many of the people are now who had fled to the north to refugee camps are coming back to the south, and they've got their own defense force, which we've worked amongst a lot. This is the elections which led to the independence on the 9th of July 2011. So just to celebrate the second anniversary, here's Salva Kiir. You may wonder, why is he wearing that hat? It looks like a Texas cowboy hat, does it not? It's a gift from President George Bush. He always wears it, and he loves to tell people, this is from George Bush. Yeah. And he's very grateful, because George Bush did help them get the independence. You don't hear many good things about George Bush, but people in South Sudan like him. And these are just some of the celebrations. Look at this poor man. He lost both his hands in the war. But the joy that they've got the independence. So, we've just had a team there for 2 minutes ministering in South Sudan. It's still a wide variety of tribes and cultures and people, but most of them Christians. And we worked amongst these men when they didn't have uniforms and when they were a very ragtag. Good to see them free at last. The new flag, the new money, and the new anthem and the crest, the fish eagle. That's at Independence Day in Juba. So, if you go on the web, you can actually listen to their national anthem, which is actually quite Christian. A statue for the founder of the South, President John Garang. He was killed in an air crash just shortly before. above that, these are the sword swallowing Sufis. We thought when I was saying sword swallowing, I was joking. They actually do swallow swords. Quite bizarre. John Garang's statue, he died in a helicopter crash, which most assume was murder. But it didn't stop the South's independence. The new constitution. So this is a defeat. The Muslims have lost a third of the territory of what was the largest Muslim country in Africa. Also, the passion of the Christ form was shown throughout the Muslim world to Muslim theatres, overflowing theatres. Never before had any Christian medium impacted the lives of tens of millions of Muslims. Missionaries in the Middle East rejoiced that more people saw the passion in a single day in their cinemas and their cities than they'd been able to show the Jesus form to in the previous 4 years of full-time Christian work. The Jesus form's banned and can only be shown secretly at great risk. But the passion is openly screened in their shopping malls. Why? Because the secular media said it's anti-Semitic. And for a Muslim, anti-Semitic's great. So, wow, an anti-Semitic film, we want to see it. And so, the Passion of Christ is not banned in any Muslim country that I'm aware of. Because the media branded it as anti-Semitic, which was a seal of approval for the Muslims. Now this is taken along with a phenomenal response to Sat7. Christian Mission Broadcasting Station, broadcasting from Cyprus throughout the Middle East. Now I remember years ago, I was off the coast of South Africa in the Doulos 2 ship, and we had a Missions Mobilizers conference dealing with the Muslim Middle East, a pretty secret meeting. We were discussing strategies, and somebody came up with Sat7. And I made the cynical comment, well, how many Muslims have access to satellite television? The man looked at his paper, he said, 50 million. Now that's back about 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. 50 million? I said, does every Bedouin have a satellite dish on the back of his camel? And he said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. There's a phenomenal prevalence of satellite dishes in the Middle East. Well, I must say, my initial skepticisms turned to admiration. Sat7's been very successful. It's one of the top effective secret weapons of Christians in the Middle East. This is reaching millions with the gospel. It's a very effective way of reaching closed countries. Taken together with the fact that there's now more missionaries focused on the Muslim world than ever before in history, not enough, but more. There's more books written on Islam from a Christian perspective than ever before. There's also more prayer focused on the Muslim world than ever before. Definitely not enough, but it's more. All of these factors, when you consider it together, represents a series of seismic events, earthquakes, that are shaking the very foundations of Islam. And I think that's why you're seeing the Arab Spring and the violence and the terrorism in Boko Haram and the Muslim Brotherhood. These are Muslim reactions of panic and fear. They're losing, and they're trying to reassert control, and they're lashing out the only way they know how, which is violently. Islam cannot survive freedom. The Quran cannot survive critical, intense scrutiny. In this technological age, I believe Islam's days are numbered. They cannot stop the internet, they cannot stop social media, they cannot stop satellite TV, they cannot stop all the radio programs, they cannot even stop all the Bibles and gospel materials we're smuggling in, including on cell phone flash drives. And there's some very, very innovative means of smuggling in materials now. And although they can hijack Western technology to use against the West, such as hijacking aircraft to fly into buildings, the foundations of Islam are rotten to the core, and it cannot stand. They're built on the sand. The scriptures declare that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. The day will come when earth will be as full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now when I first read that, I thought, 60% of the world is covered by water. We can expect the world to be 60% evangelized. But it's not saying as the waters cover the earth. As the waters cover the sea. How much of the sea is covered with water?
Pretty much 100%, yeah. But it's also true. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. There's a tremendous ignorance of Islam. And most Christians are failing to evangelize the Muslim neighbors. You think how easy it is to evangelize our Muslim neighbors. They're accessible and it's legal. There's no fear of the secret police knocking on your door because you shared a gospel tract. That has happened in Sudan. They've expelled 4,000 expatriates from Sudan in the last year. It's serious. They locked up a Swiss missionary for sharing the gospel with some Muslim neighbors. Those two girls that I mentioned to you, Heather Mosher and Donna Curry, they were put in prison and sent to death in Taliban Afghanistan for showing the Jesus film to four Muslims on a laptop. And there's no risk for us to share the gospel to Muslims in our country. That's why it's so important to have books like this. We need to understand Islam and we need to evangelize Muslims. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord the harvest, therefore, to thrust out laborers into his harvest field. Patrick Johnson put together this map. The green, the darkest, means that it's over 90% Muslim. The lighter green is 60 to 90%. And the yellow, that they under 60%. The bright yellow is over 90% Christian officially. The blue, animism. So you can see, Christianity is the strongest in the south and centre of Africa. Islam is predominant in the north of Africa. This particularly shows us where we are spiritually in the battle. A lot of South Sudan is shown as animist Christian with a bit of Muslim, but I know there's a lot more Christians there than I think they're giving credit for, but this is the official stats. So, some of our resources. Prayer maps like this, if you go onto the Frontline website, you can download this map. It's under prayer resources. We've got different maps that you can have or send around, all under resources on our website and our Facebook page and the other social media that's available. So let me show you some interesting stats which I'll get on Patrick Johnson in the Future of the Christian Church. The Future of the Global Church. It's a phenomenal book going through history. Now here you see world population percentage. Okay, yellow represents Christians, green represents Muslims. Notice the growth of Christians. High points, Muhammad born. Christians start to dip. Islam increases. Notice the Black Death, the bubonic plague, led to quite a decline because a third of Europe died in the bubonic plague. Notice the Crusades were a resurgence of Christianity. After the Crusades, we lost more ground. You can also see the World Wars brought the numbers down, a number of Christians, and so on. So basically, it's showing you how the Muslims have eaten in to the Christians a lot over the years. You can see now the number of Christians is still more than the number of Muslims, but you get a bit of a feel. We've lost the edge. We were getting a lot more, but Islam has been our worst enemy, as you can see in many ways. But our own world wars have undermined us. Now here's the division of Islam today. 84% of all Muslims claim to be Sunni. 15% would be Shiites, the others would be Sufis. Islamic sympathizers. This is officially, they reckon, those who support the terrorists. The red would be the percentage who support terrorists in Europe, West Africa, West Asia, Southeast Asia, North Africa, South and Central Asia. Obviously, the biggest percentage of pro-jihad people would come from South and Central Asia. But it's a very high percentage otherwise still, when you remember that those are potential terrorists. Okay, here you've got political situation. Notice, you've got Sharia is dark green, and Sunni is medium green. So you can see the distribution here. From the largest percentage of Muslims in the world, Iran, Azerbaijan, Iraq, and so on. Saudi Arabia might surprise you being only 93%, but why is that? Migrant workers. They've got so many foreigners. Millions of Filipinos and others coming to do all the work for them, even South Africans. You all know people who go and work in Saudi Arabia because the money's good. But still, Wahhabi and Sunni rule, very, very harsh. So you can see Qatar, Sunni, Afghanistan is in conflict, and so on. You can see Iran, totally Shiite. So this gives you a bit of a feel for where you've got, like India, the Hindus dominate, but the Muslims are still a very high percentage. So the percentage Muslim and the percentage that are Shiite on this side. Another interesting...
Pakistan is Sunni persecuting Shia.
Pakistan. 96% Muslim, but 20% of those are Shia Muslims. Now, these charts are all in the PowerPoints I just gave you on your flash drive. Now, here, the 20 countries with the largest Muslim population, India, followed by Indonesia there. They claim, according to this, in the year 2000, India was 127 million, but I believe it's gone up to 200 million by now, number of Muslims in India. Indonesia and India and Pakistan stand at the top as being the biggest Muslim countries in the world, and they expect Pakistan, India and Indonesia to continue to remain at the top. That's a prize one because none of them are in the Muslim Middle East.
Yes, and it's interesting in the first one, China is second. And the last one, it's a loss.
That's correct. The China, they've lost a lot of ground because of the communist revolution.
Yes, and if you look on the 2051, it's at the bottom, 32 out of, let's say, 2 billion people at that stage, 2030.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So that can, I mean, that can work out for Christians because they've got to be back to Israel, so they want to go through the Muslim areas as well.
So you can definitely see interesting way. Notice the colors are relevant. Red is South Asia. Yellow is East and Southeast Asia. Brown is Sub-Saharan Africa. And in the Arab world is green. Non-Arab Middle East is dark green. So you can see the surprising thing is the Middle East don't feature in the top 4 or 5, which is very surprising. Now here's the world population billions. In 1900, Muslims were 12% of the world's population. 1950, they were 14%. Year 2000, they're 21%. It's projected they reach 27% of the world's population by 2050. That's disturbing. Right. Where the world is, you've got Muslims are the green, Christians are the yellow. Obviously, we predominate in sub-Saharan Africa. In Eurasia, in North America, in Latin America. But everywhere else, we're the minority. The Muslims obviously predominate the Arab Middle East and the Persian and Turkish areas. South Asia, they're pretty significant. But in East Asia, they're a very small minority. Malaya and Indonesia, they gain a very high percentage. Distribution of Muslims by country. You can see the darkest is the highest percentage, 95%. The lightest is under 2%. And so again, you can see clearly in the 1040 window, the vast majority, the percentage of Muslims in the world in terms of the population, heavily, densely in the 1040 window. Here, what they're projecting in 2050, this is not according to the size of the country, but the size of the Muslims in that country. You can see from it all, India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia are the biggest in terms of numbers of Muslims. And the red dots are where there's war. Yellow dots where there's unrest. Funny, there's yellow and red dots everywhere. It's just that funny thing about the most peaceful, tolerant religion on earth. They just seem to attract more. But it's got to be everyone else's fault.
But you see, that would be interesting if you would take Christianity, like a chart like that, and you would take whatever other religions, and you would kind of be able to compare it and say,
yeah. But you mustn't let the facts interfere with the good story. The good story is that the Muslims are peaceful and tolerant, and the Christians are intolerant and violent. But don't let the facts interfere with that. Here's the 1040 window. You can see not religious, meaning atheistic, China's the biggest. You can see Hinduism, mostly in India, of course. But the 1040 window, the biggest block is the Muslim block, followed by the Hindu, atheistic, and Buddhist block. a little bit of Shinto. So that's looking again at the main mission fields. The yellow represents where Christianity is the majority, at least nominally. And again, you can see we've done pretty well, except the temporary window. But that's where most of the problems are. Where the church has done the least amount of work, that's where you got most of the terrorism, most of the wars, most of the persecution, most of the dictatorship. Well, exactly. The salt and the light is not there. And before 9/11, can you guess how many missionaries were dedicated to reaching the Muslims? How many full-time missionaries dedicated to reaching the 1.4 billion people in the world that were Muslims in 2000?
The same short number.
Number of Christian missionaries dedicated, all types of missionaries, from the technical guy working in the background to the person on the street. 3,000 missionaries dedicated to reaching 1.4 billion people. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. That was almost like, let's see, what is that? That is.
That's like 0.006.
That's suggesting that you had two missionaries for every million Muslims. Which is beyond ridiculously impossible. Now, the situation has improved since 2001. There's been a greater emphasis and awareness of Islam. But I don't know exactly what the number is now, but I know it's better.
So God has really used that.
He's used that bad situation for good.
Yeah.
So, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord the harvest. Therefore, to thrust out laborers into his harvest field. And that's it. It's a prayer war, first and foremost. So, all those charts, it's on the flash drive. If you want to update or make copies, you will have a chance to get those.
Is it on that schedule?
No, most of these are new ones I've just done the last few days, and therefore would not be on the disk, but I've put it on the flash drive. And so this flash drive, if you want to copy it, I've just put 18 PowerPoints on this flash drive, which is virtually everything I've shown you. I'm still working on two others for tomorrow, but you've got 18 now, and I hope to add another two tomorrow. Very good. Any other questions on this?
Sorry, yes, South Wolfsgang, you read somewhere that the South Black Christian area, does that mean that there's more Arabs in the north?
Oh, yes, yes. Now, Sudan, talking about pre-independence Sudan. Sudan before 2005 was one-third Arabs, one-third blacks. Sorry, one-third Arabs, two-thirds blacks. But two-thirds Muslim, one-third Christian. The way it works is one-third of the country were blacks who thought they were Arabs. Arabized black Muslims. They're blacks who were so Arabized they thought they were Arabs and not Muslim. So while the blacks were the majority of Sudan, Islam's the majority of religion. So in some ways there was a bit of a civil war where it was black Muslims fighting black Christians. Very hard.
That movie showed the government give the weapons and incentives and say you can take whatever you loot.
The slavery was an incentive.
Nigeria, when you talked about Boko Haram and the government, most of the population not agreeing with. I've heard a few times that Boko Haram is mostly from other countries.
Yes.
Not even Nigerian, and they come across the border.
Yeah. There's a huge internationalizing of jihad. And for example, the Syrian rebels, I've seen some pictures where they all come from all over the world. There's very few Syrians among the Syrian rebels. It's become an international jihadist event. Because Assad's regime is a secular dictatorship, military-type dictatorship, and they're wanting a radical Sharia law thing. Now, if we thought Assad is bad, his replacement would be worse, but that's the way it always is. Saddam Hussein left the Christians alone, and so the Christians are actually doing much better under Saddam Hussein's dictatorship than they are doing under Islamic democracy now. The reason is, did you know that Saddam Hussein gave such freedom to the Christians? The Christians said they had more freedom than anywhere in the Middle East, in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein. He was a brutal dictator, of course. But all of his bodyguards were Christians. And all of his chefs were Christians. Why? He couldn't trust the Muslims. He knew the Muslims might assassinate him, even though he's Muslim himself. But the Christians wouldn't ever assassinate or be involved in revolution. And anyway, it was to their interest to keep them alive, because they knew that any Muslim took over from him, it would be worse. If you go to downtown First Baptist Church in Baghdad, the huge organ is, it's got a plaque inside, gift of Saddam Hussein. Strange. But there were 1.3 million Christians in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Today there's not even 300,000. They fled. Because Islamic democracy has been more violent than a secular Muslim dictatorship. Same thing with Egypt. Egypt under Hosni Mubarak, you wouldn't have thought he was that good, or that Egypt was a great country for Christians before. They did get persecuted. But he did have soldiers outside every church protected, because it was bad for business and bad for tourism to have churches burned and so on. So whatever his motive, the point is he protected the Christians. But when the Muslim Brotherhood came in, there was no protection, and the church were all a target. So again, you could see how when America's been involved in ousting these stable dictatorships in the Middle East, the result's always been worse. You get more radical Islamists, and that's where all these jihadists come from. And Boko Haram has attracted them. They're coming from all over the Muslim world. And when we were working in Sudan, we were getting a lot of testimonies of Iraqis and Saudi Arabians coming over to sort of like we might do a short-term mission. Or that other Americans might do a short-term mission. They're coming over and they wanted to kill a Christian because that would give them a good place in paradise. And what many were, they were almost like canned lion hunting. They wanted to crucify a Christian. And the cases that Saudi Arabians had posed for pictures, I want to get all these pictures, but I'm told they exist, of Saudi Arabians posing by a crucified Christian in the mountains, you know, like some American hunter with his foot on the lion or the rhino or something. That sort of attitude. And so this is what you got a lot of Muslims who glamorize this and thinking, you know, I can get a better place in paradise if I could just kill a Christian or a Jew. Jordan. Nigeria is the place where it's happening, and so they might go like on a short-term mission.
Yeah.
That's sort of attitude. Except we might go wanting to help. These guys want to go to kill.
Yeah. And they are like, especially, it's weekly targeting the churches.
Especially.
The one case, that a car bombing in the parking lot. Oh, sorry, in the church.
Uh-huh. They're sometimes driven through the wall. Yeah.
No, I think that case they threw hand grenades.
Oh, okay.
And then everyone went out, of course, and then there was a car bombing outside in the parking lot where everyone was gathered.
That seems like these double bombings. They kept the rescue workers also.
Yeah.
Horrible.
The police.
Horrible.
They've got 20 minute intervals.
That is the worst. Yeah. The people I've ministered amongst in Nigeria, they've given horror stories of what's gone on there, but they had to fight. When the whole attacks happened in 9/11, and the church were being attacked all over northern Nigeria, the army and police were nowhere to be seen. They had to protect themselves, and only once they'd restored order did the army and the police come and gather up the weapons that they'd captured from the Muslim terrorists. But they weren't there when they needed them.
There was a big thing in Nigeria with the president not really wanting to declare a state of war, because then the foreigners from other countries would come and defend. And then America saying, no, we don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, well, America's not going to take a side against Muslims. Yeah. Not under this regime. But I had it explained to me a while ago. How many of you saw Hotel Rwanda? You did. Okay, Hotel Rwanda's got... I don't like Hotel Rwanda for several reasons. It's a Hollywood film. There's no Rwandese in the whole film. They've got American blacks and South African blacks pretending to be Rwandese, and I can immediately tell they're not Rwandese. It's all filled in South Africa, and I can tell the roads are too good, and it just isn't the same. It's not Rwanda. But the other thing is, they depict the UN as sympathetic. Helpless and useless, but they basically mean well. Whereas my experience up there was the UN was malicious. They disarmed the people and stood back and did nothing. Then they even handed over the people they were responsible for to be killed. I witnessed all that. But what's most obnoxious of all in the Herzl Rwanda film is there's no acknowledgement of the Christian faith of the Rwandese. There's no prayer, there's no hymn singing. You've got to believe there's 1,200 people in the middle of a genocide in this hotel, and nobody's praying. There's no hymns, there's no worship services. Not possible, didn't happen. I stayed in Herzl Miller's colonies. I know the area, and I spoke to the people. The people being targeted were Christians. They were Protestant Christians. The Tutsis were being targeted because they were believers. And most left this out. And certainly Herzl Rwanda left it out. And then they've got that horrible scene where the Canadian colonel, obviously based on General Dallier, who wrote the I Shook Hands with the Devil book on the whole situation, where he's trying to save some people, but then he says, they don't care. Who doesn't care? The whites, the West, the Europeans. Because you're black. You're worse than dirt. They don't care about you. Yeah. Now, who was the head of the UN at the time? An African. Kofi Annan, a Ghanaian. And Boutros Ghali from Egypt, also a key place. The one in charge of the Security Council, Kofi Annan, an Egyptian. A Ghanaian. And most of the troops in Ghana were actually black and African and Moroccan and Saharan troops. So this business of in there, all the UN troops look European. All Belgium or French or Canadians or something. Which isn't accurate. So they tried to depict it as racial. What they should have said is, you're Christians. You worse than dirt. Because the UN was involved in, at that very time, Somalia, helping black Muslims, and they were, of course, involved up in Bosnia, helping white Muslims, but they couldn't help black Christians in Rwanda. The issue there was not that they were black, it's that they were Christian. If they'd been Muslim, of course, they would have been. So, Herzl Rwanda, while it does something to get let you know a little bit of what happened, I feel it does more harm than good. The more accurate film is Shooting Dogs, which is a horrible title, but it's more accurate film. Anyone seen that? In America, it's known as Beyond the Gates, which is a better title. But Shooting Dogs is filmed by a British company, all in Rwanda, all Rwandese actors, on the actual place and location, and it's accurate. And this shows the prayer, the faith, the hymn singing, the Christian faith of the victims, which is far more honest and accurate. And it shows the UN's absolute duplicity. Shooting Dogs is the title in South Africa. Beyond the Gates in America, but it's the same film, and that is the best film on Rwanda, vastly superior. And the title comes from the missionary trying to get the UN to do something to save their lives. They say, we're not allowed to protect, we're not allowed to interfere. He says to them, why have you got rifles? No, we've got rifles to shoot the dogs that eat the corpses. He says, but you're not allowed to shoot the people who are making the corpses. You just shoot the dogs who eat the corpses. And so that's where the title comes from. It's about the stupidity of the UN mandate, which came from Kofi Annan. Yes. 10 years later, Kofi Annan finally came out with an apology. And his apology was, the world failed you. Yes. Not I failed you. Not the UN failed you. The world failed you. Now, how's that for taking responsibility? Just typical pagan mentality. The world failed you. So the UN is hated in Rwanda. And by the way, Rwanda, they found the best way of punishing the French. The French government took the architects of the genocide, and they're being protected there to this day. The French armed, trained the Hutu Interahamwe mass murderers and sent in the French Foreign Legion paratroopers to rescue them when they were being overthrown by a popular uprising to oust them, and help them retreat into Congo, creating a safe corridor for them. So France really helped the genocides. So you know what Rwanda did? Abolished French, made English official language. That really hurts France. That's the best way. And ban the UN. The UN is not allowed anywhere near Rwanda. UN is a swear word in Rwanda. And all Rwandans hate French. So the French government actually aided. And when the French Minister of Foreign Affairs was asked to justify what they were doing in Rwanda, you know what he said? We're holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. Because the Tutsis speak English and the Hutus spoke French. So, who cares if it's genocide as long as the people doing the genocide are French speaking? Isn't it disgusting? So that's why I wrote the book, Holocaust Rwanda, and I also put that in French. And we made available as a free ebook as a free PDF on the resource in French, because I think the French world needs to know. I even went to Paris to launch the book. I think the French people need to know what their government does in Africa. And that was one of the most disgusting behaviors ever. I walked in Rwanda knee deep in corpses in churches. I was so sick. I was sicker than I've ever been my whole life in Rwanda. I came out and I got every test you could get, everything, battery of tests. And at the end, all the doctors came out with was virus, in brackets, tropical. My mother's a nurse, she says that means they don't have a clue. But I wondered if it was spiritual, because I was sick for almost a month. And when I realized it's more spiritual, you know, through prayer, sorts, healing, never came back again. But I think it was just the spiritual oppression. Just the most horrible, horrible, horrible experience of my life to be there. And today, frontline mission teams ministering in Rwanda, and they said it's the cleanest, loveliest capital I've seen in all of Africa. Mm-hmm. Said Kigali, they couldn't find any litter. The police are the friendliest, the people are the friendliest. They said Rwanda is a magnificent. Now, the people running around are now the Tutsis, the victims. The victims rose up and overthrew the mass murderers. So it's a very different situation. There never was counter atrocities, retaliation. Mm-hmm. So I've got a lot of time for the Rwandese people. There's a lot of amazing things going on, but my last memories of it was horror. But I'm glad to read from our team that the Lord's doing a magnificent work in Rwanda right now.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a film of, I think it's called The Hope for Rwanda. Mm-hmm. About even the president's God, he's praying women of both sides. Mm-hmm. And how they came together through Christianity, through.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Being born again, starting to pray together, and the big thing about forgiveness.
It's an extraordinary thing. They didn't do retribution. They didn't even try to prosecute all the participants. They just are prosecuting all the organizers of the genocide, which is extremely gracious. Mm. The mobs were almost everyone. Mm. It was very, very shocking. But, yeah.